Thanks for tuning in to KPCRadio.com. This is Raised Fist Radio, where we discuss activism and social justice issues located in the Los Angeles area. I'm your host, Nick McNamara. Starting off our new season, we have our guest, Chuck O'Connell, a former professor at Pierce College, somewhat retired, and he teaches sociology. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. My pleasure to be here.
All right. So to start off, let's talk a little bit about you, how you got started in all this. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up right here in Woodland Hills, 5 miles west of Pierce College, and went to public school till the sixth grade, and went over to a Catholic school, St. Mel, and then to Chaminade, and graduated from there, went to Loyola Marymount down near LAX. And, I really wasn't an activist. I still don't think of myself as an activist. I think of myself as a teacher. But I got interested in social and political questions, questions of social justice, when I was in the seventh or eighth grade. And I would read Life and Time magazine, and which carried a lot of coverage of the civil rights movement and the nonviolent sit-ins that African-American college students would have to integrate the institutions of the South, like lunch counters at drugstores. And I noticed that the police would come in after the African Americans had been beaten by white supremacists, and the cops would arrest the African Americans and let the white supremacists go. And that got me thinking of a lot about how the system of law and order worked in the United States. And I also noticed there wasn't that much sympathy for the African Americans, which is another thing that struck me as odd, because everybody talked about equality, we're all Americans, and those kinds of contradictions stuck in my head and really focused my attention on issues like this.
So you started off sort of in more of a racial justice type mindset, thinking about mainly issues on racism.
I guess, yeah, that seems to be the way it played out, to the best of my memory, because there was a lot of Cold War propaganda about how the United States was the best, it respected all peoples, and then you see this actual reality, and you just, it's the disconnect's quite obvious. And the hypocrisy of the people in authority who would say one thing about we're all together and then do very little to punish those who enforced a regime of segregation and terrorism against people of color.
Okay, so that's very true. Also, you have I recall from your class when I took it, you talk a lot about class issues as well. And how did you bleed over from your initial sort of understanding of society and observations of society? How did that lead over into your studies of Marx and his writings, as well as other Marxist, quote, writers?
Well, there were two things that got me focused on class. As a follow-up or a supplement or a connection with issues of racism. And one was taking a class in Marxism with a philosophy professor at Cal State Northridge. His name was Alan Garfinkel, and he's since switched fields and gone over to UCLA. But he had us read some Marx, but he also had us read, besides reading The Theory of Marx, he had us read a book called Labor's Untold Story, which was about labor organizing in the United States. It's a fascinating book, reads like a novel, very well written, and it was about labor organizing and the fight back of the capitalist class against the workers. So I'm reading these stories of exploitation, people standing up for their rights, and the repression that they faced. And I realized there's something called the class struggle. It's not just a theoretical concept. It's actual history. And that was the first thing that really got me thinking about class. And then the other thing was my own life experience, having played what's called the competitive game by the rules, being a reasonable, I guess you could reasonably identify me as an achiever, maybe not an overachiever, but I got an MA and then I was working on a PhD. And one thing I noticed was even though you can achieve these degrees and your work is, you're told your work is very good, it's in some cases it's judged excellent, that doesn't mean you're going to get a job. And in fact, I noticed it became increasingly difficult to get a job, and the jobs that became more and more available were part-time jobs. And then I realized there's a disconnect between the message, if you work hard, you will do economically or financially well. And that reality of scrounging for jobs, having sometimes to work on three, even four campuses, and have paychecks that were per hour a lot lower than the tenured or full-time faculty, was really a wake-up call and really reinforced the reality of class struggle. Here in this country and around the world.
And when you realized all of this, it was sort of at the height of tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, am I right?
I don't know if it was at the height, but the Cold War was still getting played out. And, of course, all this took place in the context of this Cold War. And then I began to think about international relations and the question of socialism, which then brought in the question of not just socialism as a theory, but what were the post-revolutionary socialist societies like? So I had to begin reading in Soviet and Chinese history. I certainly wouldn't consider myself an expert, but you know, that then became a new path I had to wander down intellectually, like what happened in these revolutionary societies and eventually why did they collapse into their opposites.
And this was sort of, so it was during the Cold War, and I'm sure there was a lot of negative feelings towards anyone who might have identified with something that could be construed as communist or socialist or red. What was your experience like at the time dealing with the general air of the political speech in society compared to your own thoughts? How did they sort of conflict?
Well, it's quite interesting because what you've just said is that you grow up in a society that's tremendously anti-communist and tremendously nationalist. And a defining characteristic of American nationalism is that you wouldn't be a communist, because that's just the opposite of being a good American. So, you know, first tendency is to engage in self-censorship, partly because you imagine that people will repress you, people will shun you, or they will ostracize you. So then you have to think about how do you advance these kinds of revolutionary and subversive ideas, subversive of the existing order, in a way that gets people to consider the ideas. And actually that wasn't such a bad thing because I think it was a good incentive to think through exactly what the issues were and not speak in slogans. It's easy to speak in slogans, but how do you present the idea of, say, collective ownership of the means of production? How do you bring in the ideas of democracy in the workplace without using what you might call standard left-wing buzzwords and slogans? Because if you use those terms, people turn you off. They'll go, oh, I already pigeonholed this guy, and he's somebody I don't have to listen to because I know he's wrong. So how do you get through people's preset judgments? How do you get through their prejudices? This is part of the challenge. And it's actually a fun challenge. I mean, because you have to rethink how to present these things. And not to wander off too long in an answer, but I found that a Socratic method where you ask people what they think of democracy, what they think of justice, get them to lay out answers, and then eventually you point out, well, you basically, you know, what you've just told me is you're a communist. And then when they realize that, you get different reactions. Some people get very angry with you for doing that, which is what happened with Socrates all the time. Other people consider the point. Other people are amused and think it's great rhetorical strategy. But anyway, that's enough of the answer.
So I suppose we can move on a little from your experience towards your analysis. You mentioned sort of labor movements and workers' ownership of means of production. And I think that's very relevant, especially if you take into account – and part-time jobs. And I think that's extremely relevant if you take into account the sort of movement – I'm not sure if you could call it a movement, but the upsurge in protests and strikes going on, especially if you consider Walmart. And I was wondering sort of your analysis on how this came about and what your thoughts on where it might go are.
Well, I haven't worked out a full finished commentary on what's been happening, but certainly what we've noticed in the last few years, especially in the last few months, is this tremendous upsurge, as you put it, in activism among workers. There were Walmart flash mobs, Walmart strikes. There was the huge nationwide strike of fast food workers calling for a $15 minimum wage. There's a number of worker cooperatives being formed around the United States in the last few years. So, and this is going on in the context of international upsurges or activism. A few weeks ago, there was a tremendous strike involving millions of workers in Brazil who were quite upset over an increase in the bus fare, and then that led to demonstrations that went on for days over working conditions and pay in Brazil. Mexican teachers have been on strike and engaging in protests throughout Mexico. They had to recently be cleared out of main square in Mexico City so the president could give his traditional El Grito speech on, I believe it was September 15th. In 2006, you had students and teachers and workers take over the capital of Oaxaca State in Mexico, and they proclaimed the Oaxaca Commune. Eventually, the Federales were brought in to disperse them. But all over the world, from Europe to Africa to Asia, you see all kinds of strikes and labor activism. And on the one hand, this is very positive because now you see people collectively acting, and they can only do this if they sit down and discuss their common problems instead of treating their problems as individual problems. And they realize, you know, that they face these problems as a working class. So this is all to the good. However, there do seem to be certain limitations on what's going on. And I think the ultimate limitation is what they're fighting for. They're fighting for reforms of a system that is increasingly repressive, and in repressive both in a political sense and in an economic sense. The trend of the last 35 to 40 years has been to cut wages, and wages in all their forms, not just the direct wages you get, but wages in the indirect form, as in benefits such as medical care, retirement pay, overtime pay. And this trend has been going on without any really effective opposition. And part of the problem workers face is that they face a demise, or rather they face a tremendous limitation on what they could be asking for. They could be advocating that the people of society, the working class, the majority of society, that the workers democratically decide what is to be produced, how it's to be produced, where it's to be produced, and how it's to be distributed. They could be fighting for a system in which production is rationally organized around human need. But they're not asking for that. They're asking for higher wages. And so right away, they've set an ideological and political limitation on their work. Another limitation they face is that they are waging this struggle in the form of demonstrations, protest, a lot of talk, and they're not using the traditional tool, traditional at least up until the Cold War, the traditional tool of the labor movement, which was to organize workers to shut down industries. Today, when people talk about a strike, they basically mean withholding their labor. We're not going to work today. We're going to go on a one-day strike or a two-day strike. Yeah. These are very symbolic, and they do get attention. But if you look at the history of strikes in this country, the general idea of a strike was that it's not just that you would withhold your labor, you would shut down production, because that's what the employer really understands. When the employer can no longer produce as he or she is in competition with other capitalists. And this tactic or strategy, this broad strategy of shutting down production, basically disappeared from the labor scene in the Cold War back in the late 40s and early 50s when the ruling class — Americans don't like to think they have a ruling class, so let's just say the political establishment — forced unions to throw out all their left-wingers. Basically, the communists who had the vision, when we go on a strike, we shut down production. And this would involve solidarity strikes with other workers and so on and so forth. And all the communists were thrown out of the labor movement. And basically, the labor movement became a labor bureaucracy populated by people who were adjuncts to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And they would not embrace the kind of militant strategy that was effective. And that is still true today. The existing labor unions are led by people who are the loyal sidekicks to the Democratic Party. Their job is to get the vote out for the Democrats.
That actually leads me to off on a little bit of a tangent, but sort of, I'm not sure if you call it ironic, but certainly coincidental point. If you recall, especially from labor history, I recall reading this in the Sharon Smith book that you recommended, or more rather acquired, but the AFL and later the AFL-CIO was very opposed to the idea of a labor party or a communist party in general. They were like adamantly opposed to it, and they fought it tooth and nail, while there were other unions at the time that were more radical in their approach. Now, more recently, I believe Richard Trumka is his name, the president of the AFL-CIO. He is very adamant, or he has now actually raised concerns about whether there should be a labor party, whether labor should retract their vote from the Democrats. So it's just sort of a strange reversal that's going on that's really been making me laugh a little.
Well, one of the things that's happened with the unions and their leadership is that some people have realized that the cuts, the attacks, the cuts the workers have faced, the attacks on labor, have often come from the Democrats. The rewriting of welfare laws was under Clinton, and by restructuring welfare to make it more difficult for workers to live with unemployment, basically Clinton was attacking the working class, and the Democrats, who often blame the Republicans for not being sympathetic to the concerns of the American working class, the Democrats by and large, have carried on these kinds of attacks. Democrats have raised tuition for students, cut funding for education, and supported wars, which hurt the working class, both in this country that is sent to do the fighting and in the country where the main victims are workers.
That's very true. And also, the Democratic governor of California is proposing expansion of prisons, whereas there's other California state senators who are Democrats who are proposing that they sort of expand rehabilitation programs. Yet we have the main Democratic head of the state saying, oh no, just put more beds in, rather than an actual sort of reform.
The problem is that the Democratic Party can no longer deliver the social welfare provisions that it championed in the 30s and the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. And this is for at least two reasons. One is the economics of it all, that the American capitalism began to suffer a tremendous crisis of profitability in the 1970s. And to restore declining profits, wages had to be cut. And part of cutting wages is to cut social benefits. And because social benefits provide this kind of safety net for the workers and allow them to resist cuts in wages. If you cut the social benefits, then the workers are more inclined to accept, not that they like it, but they're just out of economic necessity forced to accept lower wages than they had before. So the whole context of what's called the crisis of profitability, or as some economists would call it, the crisis of overaccumulation, has set economic constraints on what the Democrats are willing to deliver. And remember, the Democrats are a party that's very well funded by the capitalist class. Most funding for elections, over 70%, comes from corporate America. And labor contributes maybe 6 to 8% on average. So, if you follow the rule, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. If you're a Democratic politician and most of your funding is coming out of the corporate class, you basically will have to construct policies that please that class. And so that's the economic constraint. There's also a political factor involved in the Democrats backing away from the kind of social reforms and policies that are beneficial to the working class. And that political factor is the collapse of socialist alternatives. The Soviet Union imploded right around 1990. The Chinese and Vietnamese revolutionary societies have more and more embraced private enterprise. They keep some of the Marxist rhetoric, but basically it works on a private – their economies work on a private enterprise model. And so there's really no revolutionary alternative out existing today that gives people hope. There's no competition. Capitalists back in the 30s and 40s and 50s had to deliver a certain product to say, look, we too can provide housing and medical care because they were competing against another model that was doing these things. Now there's no other model. All societies are in this race to the bottom. And politically, you know, workers in America can't say, well, what about this society? They're doing better. Well, actually, they could with respect to health care and compared to Europe and Japan and Taiwan. Their health care programs are better. But by and large, there's not an alternative. And so politically, the ruling class doesn't, what you might call the revolutionary left is disorganized. And people are still trying to sort their way intellectually and emotionally through the collapse of the socialist societies. And it's going to be some time before they figure things out and where to go. But I think you can see glimmers of hope in these these movements of workers' cooperatives, like the recovered factories in Argentina, worker cooperatives in the United States, Spain, the effort to establish a commune in the state of Oaxaca back in 2006, very vibrant movements from South Africa to Bangladesh, labor protests all through China year after year. So there is activism, and I think people are going to, over time, work out, you know, the most efficacious political strategies.
All right, so that leads me to a small topic. You mentioned the Soviet Union there before I move on to a much larger topic. The small topic that I had to ask is, I tend to ask this of anyone of left-leaning political ideology that comes in here, and I like to ask, pardon me if you don't get the reference, but trot or tanky?
One more time.
Trot or tanky? It's a question of you, towards you, about your political ideology. And I know most people have never got what I meant. So I asked McKeever, Professor McKeever, when he came in as well. So I'll explain. Trot is a sort of term used for Trotskyists.
Oh.
And tanky is what's referred to hardline, everything the USSR has done is right, and you should not question it. Or the word they like to use is, you're a revisionist.
Oh, well, the question is,
are you
am I for Trotsky? Or am I for Stalin?
It tends to be what a lot of I see a lot of arguments boil down to.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. There still are some probably mostly very old lefties out there who get engaged in that, and I think the that debate is becoming less and less important as people move beyond the limitations of that debate with the opening, or at least the partial opening, of Soviet archives. There's been a huge growth in historical scholarship that's not so much influenced by the, if you're on the left, do you want Trotsky or Stalin? Or, you know, if you're not on the left, you know, are you supporting the Cold War 100%, or are you not a good American? And we're getting more dispassionate research, and I would say that the research has offered us a more dialectical view, a nuanced view, a view of the complexities and processes and outcomes of Soviet history that can't be encapsulated in, well, are you for Stalin or are you for Trotsky? And so, you know, the short answer to your question is, to me, the question's irrelevant because it just doesn't apply. Now, if you need a longer discourse on Soviet history, I think I could pitch one, you know, but I'll let you ask the question.
Oh, no, that was a more facetious question.
Okay.
So we'll move on now. You also have a bit of focus in Middle East politics and U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. And that leads, of course, to a question about the current situation regarding Syria. The U.S. claims that there has been chemical weapon use, and I believe the U.N. has backed up that claim. They claim it was Assad al-Bashar who did it, or was it the other way around? Oh, pardon me, I forgot his name. But Bashar al-Assad, I said it backwards. So the U.S. claims that he used chemical weapons, where you have Russia, who is saying that before that there was none being used, and now, or they claim that it was the rebels, which I would not be too averse to believing, because it's not as if the U.S. has been above using chemical weapons in the past. I was wondering what your take on the whole situation has been so up to now.
Well, my tendency in situations like this is, since I'm not directly involved in making policy, is I tend to wait and see, you know, what are the more definitive reports that'll come out over time. Let's just take it as a given, just for the sake of argument, that chemical weapons were used. Well, then that leads to the question, who used them? Was it the rebels or was it the Assad regime? If the Syrian regime used them, did Assad know or did he have renegade officers who took their own initiative and used them? These are all important questions, but I immediately take an approach that you alluded to, and that is the general context. While certainly not supporting chemical weapons, I find the condemnation to be a case of the kettle calling the pot black. The United States, as well as Russia, has huge stockpiles of chemical weapons. They've agreed to destroy them. They said the stockpiles are so vast that it's going to take a long time to destroy them, several years. So this makes you wonder how they expect the Syrians, if the Syrians do have chemical weapons, and I suppose they do, how are they supposed to destroy them overnight if it's going to take the U.S. and the Russians years and years to do this? Apparently, it's not an easy matter. Another question is, why should Assad comply? I mean, if you're the leader of a Mideast country, what lesson might you draw from the invasion of Iraq? You might draw the lesson that Saddam Hussein complied with weapons inspection and the demand for weapons, the destruction of weapons of mass destruction. He complied with it in the 1990s.
That he did?
And once he had no weapons left, he got invaded. You might think that perhaps it's better to keep the weapons, which then comes with the implicit threat that you might use them on any invader. You get rid of your weapons, what's your fallback position? What's your insurance against invasion? Another comment I have to make is that if we're going to prosecute someone for having chemical weapons, shouldn't we prosecute everyone who used chemical weapons? One of the things I've studied and restudied over the years is the U.S. war in Vietnam. And from 1961 up until the early 70s, the United States for about 10 years sprayed Agent Orange on Vietnam. That's a chemical weapon. And even today, children are born in Vietnam with birth defects and tremendous deformities. And there's clinics throughout Vietnam that are set up to take care of these kids because it's really difficult, if not impossible, for their parents to take care of them. And I don't know how long the effects of Agent Orange will be with us, but when you realize the United States signed a peace treaty with Vietnam in January of 1973, and here we are, 40 and one half years later, and children are still being born with birth defects, it would seem that the leadership of the United States should be really focused on the Vietnamese victims. How come the Syrian victims are worth so much more than the Vietnamese victims? And that's a question that the media doesn't touch. That's a question that the talking heads and the pundits don't touch. That's a question that the political leadership is not going to touch.
And that it also leads to the question about whether, or not the question, but the fact that white phosphorus and depleted uranium has been used by the U.S. against enemies in the past as well, and are continuing to cause, especially in Iraq, Afghanistan, and they're causing birth defects there as well. And if they're going, the idea that they would go into another country in the Middle East and possibly use the same type of weapon that they've been using, that causes horrible problems in gene pools, and then they're going to deplore the use of a weapon of similar destruction. It seems rather hypocritical. And then, I'm sorry to keep talking here when you seem to have a response, but and then it also goes to show that when it shows that it's so that they only bring these concerns up when it's useful to them, really.
Yeah.
Especially when you take into account that Israel, I've read reports that Israel used white phosphorus in 2008 in their attack on Gaza, and there has been no stink made about that, our ally in Israel.
Well, this is part of the double standard of politics around the world, that there's inconvenient truths that just have to be ignored. You don't call your allies on certain issues. You don't call yourself on certain issues. You ignore that, and you call the enemy or the purported enemy on these issues. You brought up the depleted uranium, and there have been reports that the U.S. used it in the first Gulf War and then used it again, particularly in the battle to take the city of Fallujah back in 2004. And I believe it was Democracy Now a few months ago ran a report on the spike in birth defects among Iraqi families in Fallujah. So this is still an ongoing issue. Of course, nobody's making the claim that, you know, George Bush or Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson used chemical weapons and this is a crime against war. And you know, these are all honored people. And it just shows that there is this tremendous double standard in politics, and people should be aware of it. If they want to have a double standard, they should just come out and say, we have double standards, and that's it. But typically, they just don't even bring up the issue.
That's very true. And they also have I've also read reports about how a lot of this might be stemming from Syria's refusal to allow an oil pipeline to be built through their territory. So, would you have any thoughts on how that might influence the U.S.'s opinion or decision to want to invade?
That wouldn't surprise me, but if that's true, I would say it's probably one factor in a basket of factors. You know, I think there's other issues involved. You know, one would be, you know, making the Syrian regime more open to neoliberal economic policies. And another would be to break its connection with Iran, or perceived connection to Iran, and try to create a more pro-Western, particularly U.S. and British, regime. And the effort seems to be to create regime change throughout the world, and particularly in the Middle East, and establish regimes that are loyal to the U.S. and their sidekicks, the British. And maybe oil is one factor. But neoliberal economics and the politics of the Middle East, making sure that Iran becomes more isolated, is probably, you know, factors of greater import than an oil pipeline.
All right. And also, there's a lot of onus being put, or a lot of attention being paid to Assad's forces, but no one has, or the U.S. doesn't raise many concerns about what the opposition forces might be doing. If you take a lesson from Libya, and when they had Gaddafi overthrown, the group that came in immediately after her had a little bit of a campaign of going around and lynching the African population of Libya. There was a lot of that going around, and there was no real concerns raised about that group, the one that the U.S. supported. And I have concerns about whether – I've heard reports that the U.S. is militarily supporting the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and I have concerns about what this support could mean for Syria if they were to succeed in taking Assad out of power.
Well, you'd probably get some new ruling class with corrupt leaders ready to live high on the hog and pledge their loyalty to the U.S. You might get people who say, thanks for the help, but we're going to go our own way. you know, I haven't read yet, not that it's not out there, but I haven't read yet any good political analysis of the various parties in the Syrian opposition. I do know that there's claims that the U.S. is actually, ironically, helping al-Qaeda-type forces.
Yeah, I've heard that
as well. Which is a supreme irony, since the U.S. engaged in military operations to crush al-Qaeda, you know, to be supporting that against Assad is bitterly ironic.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's, you know, these kinds of politics seem to operate on the principle, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And what they really stand for is not that important, because right now they're performing a useful role of raising a military insurrection. And, you know, then, you know, the Americans, you know, would hope that they're successful, and then hope for the best, that hope with, you know, the triumph of a new regime, you can work with them. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. The United States put Ngo Dinh Diem in power in Vietnam in 1955, and turned out while he did many things the Americans supported, he wasn't that compliant of a puppet. And by 1963, November 1st, 1963, the U.S. Implicitly endorsed his forced removal from office. You know, flash forward, you know, about 35 years later, and the United States puts Hamid Karzai into power in Afghanistan after it invades. And Karzai, a former consultant for UNICAL, is now president of Afghanistan, thanks to the USA. But if you follow the ins and outs of the U.S.-Afghan relationship, you can see that Karzai is not a compliant puppet, and is basically concerned with his power base. And if the U.S. policies get in the way of his power base, then, you know, he stands in opposition to the U.S. So what you would get with a new regime in Syria that the U.S. may bring to power is something I can't forecast right now.
All right. And so just to end here, I would like you to just tell me a little bit, because we've been talking a lot about U.S. imperialism. Just a quick, sort of quick statement on what the U.S.'s gain from these types of imperialist actions are.
Now that's a really good question. It gets dead soldiers, wounded soldiers, families that have to deal with the loss of their loved ones. It gets death and destruction. It's hard to forecast what you get, but we can go back to past situations to make an assessment. For example, in the case of Vietnam, the United States got 58,165 dead Americans, tens and tens and thousands of wounded Americans, a huge deficit, and got a country that was so destroyed that even though the U.S. left Vietnam, was basically forced out for a variety of reasons, that even though the U.S. left and the opposition came to power, that opposition had a country with 3 to 4 million dead, tens and tens and tens of thousands wounded, missing in action, ecological destruction on a tremendous scale, and then faced an embargo by the World Bank at U.S. instigation to force it to accept loans from the World Bank on terms of the World Bank. And basically, the Communist Party of Vietnam, in an effort to rebuild the country, prostituted itself to World Bank, the neoliberal economic policies of the World Bank. And now the Vietnamese quite cheaply make goods for the Americans. So you can't argue that the U.S. won the war. U.S. corporations get to invest in Vietnam, have tremendous cheap labor. And for a U.S. corporation, what's the price? 58,000 dead Americans and 3 to 4 million dead Vietnamese? You know, they're making their money 40 years later.
They're meeting their bottom line.
And even if no company makes direct profits, one of the beneficial outcomes for the political establishment or the ruling class, which I think is a preferred term, is that they raise the price of rebellion. If the poor and the downtrodden of the world rise up and they find out that, for example, in Vietnam, the price of victory comes with 3 to 4 million dead people, not to mention the wounded, not to mention the environmental destruction, that, you know, maybe you don't rebel. Maybe the price of it all is too much, and maybe the better deal is just to keep your head down and comply and just live with what you got. And that's, you know, that's a victory for the imperialist.
All right. And I believe we're just about out of time. So I'd like to thank our guest, Chuck O'Connell, for coming on and talking to us a little here today. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
All right. You are listening to Raised Fist Radio, show on activism and social justice issues focused in the L.A. area. Stay tuned for more programming on kpcradio.com.